Okay, well, welcome everyone to the Quantum Matter Frontier seminars. So these are a series of very high quality talks that I'm very excited about. So these are organized by me, Yongbek Kim, Anton Berkov, and Sangsik Lee. They'll be going on pretty much every week, Monday, 12:30 at this time until the beginning of December, I think. So yeah, I hope you're as excited as I am about these talks, and feel free to ask questions, et cetera. So, yeah, Yongbek, do you want to take over?
Oh, sure. Okay. So before we begin, I like to ask all the participants to turn off the video and also the mute yourself. If you have any questions, then you can raise your hands in the participant window. Or you can write in the chat and say that I have a question and things like that. Or you can type your question, then I'll pick you up and you can unmute yourself at that point. So the first talk in the series will be given by Senter at MIT. And so, I mean, Senter doesn't need any real introduction, but he's a professor at MIT. He's an expert in topological phase of matter. And today, so he's going to give a talk about his recent work on composite fermions, composite fermion liquid, and non-commutative field theory. Okay, please go ahead, Senter.
Thank you, Yongbek, and thank you, Tim, Anton, Sumsik, for organizing this series and for inviting me to give a talk in this series. It's a wonderful topic to be hosting a seminar series about. So I very much look forward both to giving this talk and to listening to all the other future talks in the series. So let me get started. So the work that I'm going to talk about was done with a graduate student at MIT, Jihuan Dong, that's him. And we posted a paper sometime in the summer, and there's another paper that we are planning on writing. And I've also been collaborating with two postdocs at MIT, Hart Goldman, who just moved to MIT, and Adrian Po, who's on his way out of MIT to a position in Hong Kong. All right. So we are talking about frontiers in quantum matter, and quantum matter is one of those things where there's a large number of frontiers. It's like a high-dimensional object with many directions in which it's poking out. So I want to talk about one particular frontier that I'm particularly interested in. And this is the physics of what happens when two of the big themes of modern condensed matter physics collide with each other, namely that of band topology, which has been of tremendous interest in the last 15, 16 years, and strong correlation physics, which has been of interest for many decades. Right? So what is the physics of interacting electrons when you have a partially filled topological band? So there's many reasons to be interested in this question, but my own interest was sparked by working on these famous Murray-Graffin materials in the last 2.5 years. And it turns out that this question that I described in very broad terms in blue is the main conceptually new theoretical problem that's posed by Murray-Graffin materials. In many of these materials, we know by now that the bands are topological, and of course the band filling can be varied continuously with gates, and there's all kinds of strong correlation physics that's seen. So we are forced to think about the question of how to describe interacting electrons in a partially filled topological band. So apart from Murray-Graffin materials, there's a huge experimental search for materials in which the bands are nearly flat and topological. A nice recent example is this class of materials. It's a class of materials based on the Kagome lattice. A nice example is cobalt tin, that was synthesized and studied by my colleagues, Joe Chikelsky and Ricardo Comen. So this is an ongoing search, and the hope in the research program of Chikelsky and Comen is that they synthesize materials, ordinary solids, where the important, the bands near the chemical potential are reasonably flat, reasonably narrow, so that strong correlations are important, D electron based materials with narrow bands. And furthermore, that the bands are topological, right? So this is something that experimentalists are actively searching for in ordinary solids. And we already have this Moiré material where this physics is at play. Okay, so let me start by reviewing how we microscopically model a typical correlated solid. So in a typical correlated solid, there'll be a bunch of bands near the chemical potential, and they'll be separated by energy gaps with empty bands above the chemical potential and with fully filled bands well below the chemical potential. And oftentimes, the definition of these remote bands is that not only are they separated by band gaps from the active bands near the chemical potential, but also that the strength of the interaction is much smaller than the gap between the active bands and the remote bands. So in that situation, it's legitimate to project the interaction to these active bands to obtain an effective model in the block basis, right? So the band theory, of course, starts off in the block basis, and then we take the interaction and we project it to just these active bands to get an effective Hamiltonian, right? And that Hamiltonian will take the following form. There's a band structure piece, and then there's an interaction piece, right? And in addition, in general, we have to worry about phonons, we have to worry about impurities and things of that sort. Okay, so that's always correct. It's quite common to describe this kind of solid through an interacting effective model that lives on a lattice, to work with a lattice model, so like a Hubbard model. And the way it is to go between the Hamiltonian formulated in the block basis to one formulated in a real space lattice is well known. It's in all the textbooks. And you first transform from the block basis to a Wannier basis. So you construct these Wannier functions defined as Fourier transforms, lattice Fourier transforms of the block functions. And you recast the Hamiltonian in the previous slide in this real space basis. And these Wannier functions, there's one Wannier function associated with each lattice site R. And for ordinary bands, meaning non-topological bands, we know that well-localized Wannier functions that transform nicely under the microscopic symmetries can always be constructed. So then you have a nice basis of localized real space orbitals. And you can transform the original problem in the previous slide, which was written in the block basis, to the Wannier basis to get a tight binding model, and then put in the rewrite the interactions in that basis. And that gives you an effective interacting lattice model, okay? So this kind of effective lattice model is, of course, extremely common as the starting point to describe strong correlation physics in conventional solids, okay? Now, so this paradigm is challenged in the situation that's of interest in this talk, where you have both where band topology meets strong correlations, right? So let me explain why band topology challenges this paradigm. So let me illustrate that with the simplest example of a topological band, namely a Chern band in two dimensions of the kind discussed originally by Thouless and Haldane in the 1980s. So we know that in two dimensions for an isolated band, the total momentum space magnetic flux, you take the very curvature in K space, and you integrate it over the Billmore torus, then you get a number that's quantized in integer multiples of 2 pi, and this integer is what's known as the Chern number. And geometrically, this Chern number counts the number of baryonic monopoles inside the k-space torus. And because it simply counts the number of magnetic monopoles, it's a topological invariant, and bands for different Chern number are known to be topologically distinct. Right? Smooth change of the Hamiltonian cannot, without a phase transition, change the Chern number of the band. So the physical consequences of Chern number are also well known. A Chern insulator is a material that has a filled Chern band. And when that happens, there is a quantized Hall conductivity where sigma xy is precisely the Chern number times e squared over h. So sigma xy directly measures the Chern number of the filled Chern band. So this is the integer quorum Hall effect. It's in this context called a Chern insulator. And there's many famous related phenomena, there's chiral edge states and so on and so forth. And this and clearly these phenomena require the breaking of time reversal symmetry. Okay. All right. Now, the presence of Chern number has a direct consequence for the ability to transform from the block basis to a set of well-localized Wannier functions. So this is intuitively clear, but there's a formal theorem that was proven by Bruder, Marzari et al. In 2007 that exponentially localized Wannier functions cannot be constructed for Chern bands. So Chern bands are the one exception where you cannot go from the block basis to a localized Wannier basis. And the intuition is that since the Chern band encloses the magnetic monopole in momentum space, the phase of the block wave function cannot be globally well defined, and therefore the integral in the integrand in the k-space integral that defines the Wannier function is not smooth, and this lack of smoothness of the integrand means that you can't localize the Wannier function. Now, a corollary of this theorem is that a correlated partially filled Chern band cannot be simply described by a lattice effector model. The only way to do that is to introduce extra auxiliary bands, you know, which are purely, play a role of a spectator, which are such that they cancel the Chern number. So then by combining the two bands, you can write down a lattice model, and then you turn on interactions in that lattice model. And then you have to worry about how to keep track of the fact that your auxiliary band was really just a spectator and had no real involvement in the essential physics of the system. Okay, so this is the complication with trying to construct a lattice model for a partially filled Chern band. And you want to construct a lattice model in situations where you want to worry about strong correlations. Okay. So there is, in fact, a special situation of a correlated topological band where we do understand the physics quite well, and that's the quantum Hall effect. Now, indeed, a single lambda level can be viewed as a special case of a Chern band, namely one with flat energy dispersion and also with a flat Berry curvature. It's a very ideal limit. It's a very, very special limit of a Chern band. And we know that strong correlations at partial filling give rise to the beautiful physics of the fractional quantum Hall systems. This trace is perhaps one of the most famous traces in modern condensed matter physics. The Hall conductivity nicely quantized in steps in the quantum Hall regime. And of course, we do not understand the quantum Hall effect in the lambda level in terms of lattice tight binding models. But we have other ways of thinking about quantum Hall physics, right? In terms of wave functions, in terms of effective field theories, all kinds of other things. But we don't describe it through a Hubbard model or some such lattice interacting model. Okay. So how to deal with strong correlations away from the special lambda level limit of a Chern band or for other topological bands? It's largely an open question in many body physics. Right? That it's not been addressed in the literature before, nor has there been any pressing reason to address it in the literature before. But now with the advent of Moire graphene and these other systems that people are trying to make, we are forced to think about, we are forced to come to grips with the issues presented by this kind of problem. So the natural question that one can ask is, in terms of trying to develop a general theory for this kind of situation, can we base the theory on our understanding of correlated lambda levels, right? The quantum Hall, the physics of quantum Hall systems. And the answer is that maybe you can, maybe we can, but there are some problems that we'll have to confront. So let me describe two problems with saying, look, there's just a replay of quantum Hall physics.
I said there.
Yeah.
There was a question from Leo. Leo, sure. Do you want to speak?
Just a simple question. I missed the point why adding the spectator bands is not satisfactory solution.
Yeah, so if you have interactions which do not mix the, they generically, when you go to the lattice model, including this auxiliary band, your interactions will mix the degrees of freedom of the physical band, the band you're interested in, with the degrees of freedom in the auxiliary band that you introduced by hand.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So how to separate these two things is not a priori clear.
I see.
They get mixed up in some complicated way.
But that's maybe the physics, right? Or
no, the auxiliary band is something you put in by hand just so that you could construct the lattice model. It cannot affect anything in the physics.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Sure. Other questions?
Yeah, perhaps to continue on Leo's question, isn't it the same thing as saying in quantum Hall that the interaction should be smaller than the inter-Landau deficit?
Yeah, that's right.
Good thing, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So let's see what it takes to base a theory on our understanding of correlated lambda levels, right? And what are the complications that we'll have to surmount? So the first problem, and I'm going to use the Moire topological bands as an example because that's very concrete. And as people have been doing experiments left, right, and center in this system. So there are many differences between a lambda level and a Moire topological band. First, the Moire bands are time reversal symmetric. So roughly speaking, it's like a system with two sets of lambda levels corresponding to equal and opposite fields coupled together by interactions, right? So that's already one difference. Another difference is that even when there are churn bands, the Berry curvature is not uniform within the Bernoulli zone, unlike in a lambda level, okay? And finally, the bandwidth is not zero. And indeed, experimentally, it turns out that it can be tuned very easily in some of these Moire systems, right? So all these differences with standard quantum Hall physics. So we sort of have to work harder and not just say that this is going to be a repeat of quantum Hall. So despite that, intuition from quantum Hall is less likely to misguide than say intuition from Hubbard model physics or other such lattice, Hubbard, TJ, Kondo lattice, whatever lattice model you like. And it could be a viable starting point in thinking about these partially filled topological bands. But there is another problem in attempting to generalize from lambda levels, and that's in fact the more basic problem. And the more basic problem is that, even within quantum Hall, to a large extent, the physics of quantum Hall is extraordinarily well understood. But there is a technical problem in quantum Hall physics, which has not really been sorted out, which is the question of how to deal analytically with a microscopic model that's restricted to a single lambda level. Right? So this is hard, and it's never been satisfactorily understood, even in the classic quantum Hall effect. And this is precisely the kind of question that we're asking in trying to generalize away from a lambda level to other churn bands or other kinds of topological bands. You want to forget about these remote bands and develop a framework to discuss the physics entirely in the active topological band, right? But even within quantum Hall, this has never been satisfactorily understood analytically, right? There's beautiful work with wave functions where you can try to calculate properties of the wave functions numerically. And the intuition for the phenomenon, the quantum Hall regime, is extremely well developed, but dealing analytically with the microscopic model restricted to a single lambda level, it's not that well developed. And that's one of the challenges that we'll have to confront to move ahead. So the research program that I've been engaged in, which will also serve as a plan of the talk, is the following. Right? So given that there's a new frontier in many-body physics, maybe the best thing to do is to start by studying some simple models to get to wet our feet and gain some intuition and learn, you know, and develop some methods. So I want to identify simple models to study the interplay of band topology, strong correlations, and the kinetic energy of the particles, right? So the kinetic energy basically means that there's a finite bandwidth, right? And so the first thing to do is to revisit old unsettled questions in quantum Hall physics about physics within a single lambda level. And usually, it's sufficient to take this to be just the lowest lambda level. That's part one. And part two is to broaden the lambda level into a churn band so that we introduce kinetic energy into the problem and then to study the competition with the kinetic energy. Okay? So let me start with part one and talk a little bit about physics, at least one old and fundamental unsettled question about quantum Hall physics within a single lambda level. So 2D electrons in the quantum Hall regime, I already showed this lovely plot. So at integer fillings, we get the integer quantum Hall effect, and at certain fractional fillings, we get the fractional quantum Hall effect. And at even denominator fillings, like a half, what you get experimentally is a metal with both rho xx and rho xy not zero, but rho xx is much smaller than rho xy. So this is a very interesting state of matter doesn't look on the face of it, if this is the first time you're seeing this trace, doesn't look as interesting as the plateaus. But it turns out that this is actually one of the key pieces of the quantum Hall story. And it's a state that's known as a composite Fermi liquid. So the theory, the accepted theory of, the largely accepted theory of the composite Fermi liquid goes back to Halperin, Lee, and Reed from 1993. So they had this idea they imported an idea introduced earlier by Jane Rejane in 1989, who said that a useful way to think about quantum Hall phenomena is to transform the electrons to what are known as composite fermions by attaching two flux quanta to the electron to form a new fermion, which is the composite fermion. And this composite fermion sees a reduced effective field instead of the original field B, since it's formed by eating up some of the flux quanta. It sees a reduced electric magnetic field. And at nu equals half, this effective magnetic field is zero, and these composite fermions can form a Fermi surface. So that's the essence of the HLR theory. And so this idea can be converted into an effective field theory for the composite Fermi liquid. And this effective field theory has the structure of these composite fermions coupled to a dynamical U1 gauge field. And this U1 gauge field has a Chern-Simons term. And this effective theory can, in some approximation, be used to calculate physical properties of the system. So apart from filling nu equals half, composite Fermi liquids also exist at other even denominator fillings. Electrons at nu equals a quarter form a composite Fermi liquid. Now, theoretically, there's a long literature studying quantum Hall states of bosons. And bosons at filling nu equals 1 can also potentially form a composite Fermi liquid. Now, it turns out that in numerics, bosons at filling nu equals 1 with short range interactions form a version, different state that is obtained from the composite Fermi liquid by pairing the composite fermions. But the metallic state is still worth studying as a possible putative ground state at that filling for some Hamiltonian. So in all these cases, the same generalization of the H-Lohr idea admits a composite Fermi liquid ground state. And the common structure in all of these is that the effective theory is a Fermi surface plus U1 gauge field with Chern-Simons coupling. So these composite Fermi liquids are central to our overall understanding of quantum Hall phenomena. And that's part of the reason why H-Lohr is much revered. The many, many successes of the H-Lohr theory. It explained and successfully predicted many aspects of the observed metallic state. It acts as a parent state for this prominent sequence of quantum Hall states described by Jain using the composite fermion construction. It also acts as a parent state of paired non-abelian quantum Hall states at the same filling. And it's backed up successfully in many aspects of it are backed up successfully by numerics. Okay, so this is it's a wonderful theory, but despite all these successes, there were vexing open questions that people thought about extensively in the 1990s and simply abandoned without any resolution. So I'm going to, in the next two slides, I'm going to describe some of these open questions, which are quite fundamental. The first unsatisfactory aspect of the H-Lohr theory, it's something that I wasn't able to see who was speaking, but I guess that the voice was Jan Zernens. He was just asking me about. So the theory should make sense within the lowest Landau level, which is something that you obtain in the limit where the interaction energy suppose you're working in a limit where the interaction energy is much smaller than the Landau level spacing. So then it's legitimate to forget about these higher Landau levels and project the Hamiltonian to the lowest Landau level, right? So the theory should be well defined in the limit in which the problem is entirely defined within the lowest Landau level, but the H-Lohr formalism is not suited to projecting to the lowest Landau level. For instance, the mean field effective mass in the H-Lohr theory of the composite fermions is the bare electron mass. And the lowest Landau level limit can be formally obtained by taking the cyclotron frequency to infinity, which means you take the bare mass to zero. But then what happens to the H-Lohr theory, right? So this issue of how to formulate H-Lohr entirely within the lowest Landau level was discussed a lot in the late 90s. By all the leading lights of the field, but the dust never settled and people simply moved on. So in light of the kinds of modern problems we are trying to describe, clearly, we have to learn, we have to come to grips with this problem, right? The experience of learning to work within the lowest Landau level is going to be useful in other contexts, as the lowest Landau level is the simplest example of a topological band. Now, there's another problem, which was also initially discussed in the 90s with the H-Lohr theory, projected to the lowest Landau level. At nu equals half, the theory has an extra particle hole symmetry that the H-Lohr theory is blind to. So this particle hole symmetry comes from thinking about the half-filled lowest Landau level as either being filled with particles or a complete Landau level from which you've removed half the particles, right? So this issue has a nice resolution only in the last few years, thanks to an idea that Dan Sohn, who I believe is speaking next week, but not on this topic, came up with. So the proposal that Sohn, the idea that Sohn had was to describe the composite fermions as Dirac fermions, at finite density coupled to a U1 gauge field with some action. And subsequent work by many people, including myself, has made it almost completely certain that Sohn's theory is in fact the correct description if you want to retain particle hole symmetry in the theory at half filling. So I personally believe that the issue of particle hole symmetry has been resolved. And so I'm not going to talk about it much further today. But the key comment to make is that all this progress with particle hole symmetry in the half-filled Landau level sidestepped the issue of lowest Landau level projection, right? So Sohn found a way to sidestep this issue, but I won't go into exactly how. But it enabled progress on the issue of particle hole without confronting the more basic issue of lowest Landau level projection. Okay, so let me define the basic problem. And this is sort of going to be the poster child, the sort of the simplest setting in which we can think about how to formulate the problem of correlations in a single topological flat band. Right? So the basic problem is that we have particles in the lowest Landau level with two-body repulsive interactions. Okay. So pick some basis for the single particle states in the lowest Landau level. Let me call it M. Now, many body states are spanned by N particle states, M1 to MN, suitably anti-symmetrized for fermions or symmetrized if you're thinking about bosons. And in the lowest Landau level, there is no kinetic energy. So you only have interaction energy, which is written in the usual way in terms of the density operators of the particles. And the early catch is that the density operators are projected to the lowest Landau level, and this projection changes their algebraic structure, and it's known from work going back to Gerwin, MacDonald, and Plotzmann in the 1980s that these projected density operators, their algebra, their commutation algebra closes, and the commutator of two rho L's is some prefactor times rho L at Q plus Q prime, right? So this Hamiltonian defined in this Hilbert space with this commutation algebra completely defines the quantum Hall problem at any filling in the lowest Landau level. And this U of Q is up to a form factor, basically simply the Fourier transform of the microscopic two-body interaction. So if we can solve this Hamiltonian, then as a matter of principle, we know everything about the quantum Hall effect, all the physics of in the quantum Hall regime that happens within the lowest Landau level. Okay? So clearly this, for suddenly a Coulomb interaction or something, there is no parameter to perturb in, right? The entire quantum Hall problem is non-perturbative, and the strength of U will simply set the scale of energy levels in the system. And LB will set the scale for lengths in the system. Okay? So though there wasn't much progress, or there was some progress, though the problem of how to describe the composite from a liquid in the lowest Landau level never got fully resolved, there was important progress in the 1990s for the composite from a liquid, for the particular example of a composite from a liquid of bosons at nu equals 1. So this progress began with two papers, first by Pasquier and Haldane in 1998, who found a redundant representation of the density operator that satisfies this GMP algebra in terms of ordinary fermions. In modern language, we'll call them fermionic partons. So these fermionic partons will turn out to be the lowest Landau level version of composite fermions. And it's a redundant representation. I'll describe this in more detail, but the preview is that it's a redundant representation. And this redundancy means that we need to impose constraints to recover the physical Hilbert space. And it turns out that these constraint operators themselves satisfy a GMP algebra, but with opposite sign from the physical density operator. Now, incidentally, this algebra is known to mathematicians as a W infinity algebra. I actually don't know why it's called W infinity, but it's so I'll sometimes refer to this as W infinity algebra. For our purposes, we can just think of W infinity as some limit of SUN when n goes to infinity. Okay.
So there is a question from the audience.
Yeah.
And the question is, do you know how to couple the Lois Landau level in this formulation with the external background, like EM field, the metric, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so certainly for the background electromagnetic field, we do know how to couple. It's subtle. There are many subtleties associated with that, but people have resolved those subtleties already in the late 80s and early 90s. So we know how to couple the many body states, lowest Landau level, to external cage fields. Okay. So I'm not going to describe that in any detail right now, because that's an interesting story in itself. If you wish, the right way to do it, one way to do it is to start with the full set of Landau levels and then do the projection in the presence of the small of the perturbation to the external gauge fields. Okay. All right. So the second important progress that built on this Pasquier-Haldane representation was due to Nick Reed, also in 1998. So he pointed out that these constraints and their algebra means that the redundancy in the representation can be thought of as introducing a huge gauge group, a W infinity gauge group. But fortunately, that huge gauge group is broken by the mean field composite Fermi liquid, the more familiar group U1. So then the low energy theory is a Fermi surface plus a U1 gauge field, right? Which looks great because that's what we expect for the theory of the composite Fermi liquid. So Reed treated the fluctuation effects beyond the mean field diagrammatically within a conserving approximation. And the answers were very nice and very sensible physically, so things look good. There's not been much further development since these papers from 22 years back. And if we try to think about the story, it becomes immediately clear that there's a number of questions that were left open by these developments, okay? So can we write down a low energy action, an effective field theory, instead of just calculating correlations through a diagrammatic calculation? How is this low energy effective theory related to the HLR action? Because the original HLR action is not derived within the lowest Landau level, it's derived through a flux attachment procedure, which is not faithful to the Landau level projection. So how do we treat the competition with the paired bosonic Pfaffian at the same filling? How do we describe the Jane states away from filling one? And can we generalize these methods to other problems that we may be interested in? So I'm mainly going to talk about for the next several minutes, I'm going to talk about the first question, what is the low energy effective field theory? So over the years, there have been a few suggestions of what this effective field theory might be. So one idea, which actually goes back to Reed's original paper, is that in this theory that comes from the Pasquier-Haldane-Reed approach, that we should think of the composite fermion as a fermionic vortex. And there's a Lagrangian that this line of thinking leads you to, where the fermions are coupled to a U1 gauge field. And this U1 gauge field, little a is a dynamical U1 gauge field, and capital A is an external background U1 gauge field. And the background gauge field couples in some way to the theory. But the important thing to note about the suggested action is that there is no Chern-Simons term for the internal gauge field, right? So this should be contrasted with the usual HLR action, which I've written down here for completeness for bosons at mu equals one, where there's again a fermion coupled to U1 gauge field, but there is a Chern-Simons term. So this kind of theory effective field theory was actually suggested in Reed's original paper, but it wasn't explicitly derived. All the calculations were through diagrammatics. And the question then is H Lord really correct for bosons at near equals one? Or is it this theory that's correct? Or maybe these two Lagrangians, even though they are formally different, do they describe the same IR physics, or are they distinct theories? So there's really a question of which one, if any, is actually obtained by starting with the microscopic description of Pasquier, Haldane, and Reed. Now, there's a different approach based on flux attachment and duality to bosons at nu equals one by Matthew Fisher and his then junior but now distinguished senior collaborators, which led to this form of the which led to this field theory, but this derivation was not in the lowest Landau level, right? And there was another suggestion a few years back by Chong Wong and myself, where we suggested that there may be a Fermi surface Berry phase that when you project to the lowest Landau level, that converts the HLR theory to this form, and that perhaps this form was what's actually correct. But none of this was, the situation was actually pretty unclear. And I'll tell you what our new analysis shows. So we've analyzed this, we've revisited this system, and we have an answer, right? So our claim is that this bosonic composite Fermi liquid is described by a certain kind of quantum field theory known as the non-commutative field theory of fermions plus a U1 gauge field without any Chern-Simons term, right? So this is similar to what was suggested in Reed's paper, except that the theory is a non-commutative field theory and it's not an ordinary quantum field theory. And so then we took this non-commutative field theory, and it turns out there's an approximate way to map this field theory to an ordinary commutative field theory, so long as you're only interested in low, long wavelength, low amplitude gauge fluctuations. And remarkably, the result of that mapping was that it gave us exactly the HLR theory. Sorry, this is a typo, this should be subleading. With subleading corrections, but with parameters determined correctly by interactions. And it's a technical tool that we use for this purpose that was developed by Cyberg and Witten in 1999, actually around the same time as Pasquier, Haldane, and Reed. So what are non-commutative field theories, right? So these are field theories that are defined in a space-time where the spatial coordinates do not commute with each other. And there's a long history in the physics and math literature of studying quantum field theories defined in such a space-time. And it was the big fashion in high-energy physics for about 5 years, from 1998 to 2003, till people moved on and the fashion changed and other things started being studied. Now, in the condensed matter context, of course, the best example of such a space is the lowest Landau level, where we know that the two guiding center coordinates of or single particle states do not commute. So perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that effective field theories within the lowest Landau level are non-commutative field theories. And in fact, there have been, over the years, proposals for how to describe the quantum Hall states, the incompressible quantum Hall states, using a non-commutative Chern-Simons description by Susskind and Polykronokos and others. So there's a slowly moving literature on this topic. Now, at least to me, it's not clear what the connection to microscopics is in these proposals. And furthermore, it's not also clear to me what value this adds to the standard commutative TQFT description, the topological quantum field theory description that we use to basically, understand all the universal properties extraordinarily well of the incompressible states. So here, my focus is on the metallic state of bosons at mu equals one, where we'll see that a non-commutative field theory plays a role. So let me now describe a little bit more detail what the Pasquier-Hordain Reed construction is. So those of you who are familiar with slave boson representations of, say, the TJ model or something like that, should really think of this as being in the same spirit, but it's much more complex. It's in the same spirit, but it's much more complex. Right? So the physical states, or states in the many-body boson-Hilbert space of this type, right? M1 to Mn, where n is the degeneracy of the Landau level, and it's also the number of particles because we are at filling nu equals 1. And the main idea is to write such a state, it represents such a state in terms of fermion operator Cmn, which which have two indices, m and n, each one of which runs from 1 to n, and which satisfy the usual fermionic anti-commutation relations. And you start from the quark vacuum of these fermions and act with n such fermion creation operators. But then you anti-symmetrize the resulting state over the n index, right? Now, when you anti-symmetrize it over the n index, since the fermions anti-commute, the right-hand side is naturally symmetric in the m index, right? It's anti-symmetric in n, but the fermion operator is anti-commute, and so it's symmetric in the M index. So therefore, it gives you a representation of symmetric many body states of this kind. And therefore, these describe bosons at filling nu equals 1. So the physical states, which are these objects, because you formed, so some of our repeated indices is assumed. Because you've completely anti-symmetrized the state in the N index, the physical states are singlets under SUN rotations on the right of the CMN. So if you rotate the N index by an SUN rotation, the physical states do not see that at all, right? So which means that the generators of these SUN rotations to the right of this operator, they satisfy a constraint that these generators must be equal to the identity matrix, identity operator in the physical Hilbert space. On the other hand, the left SUN rotations, where you rotate the M index, they act on the physical indices, and they are physical operators, and they'll correspond to density operators in the lowest Landau level. So the limit that M goes to infinity, the thermodynamic limit, and where we take M and N to be a single particle basis states for a Landau level, we have a representation of the physical system of bosons at nu equals 1 in terms of these weird fermions with two indices. Okay? So now, so that may look unfamiliar, but it can be made to look a bit more familiar by Fourier transforming to momentum space. So to do that, we use the magnetic translation operator in the lowest Landau level, which I'll call tau k. So this is what will enable us to define a Fourier transform, and tau k, this operator, acts on single particle states in the lowest Landau level, and it's defined to be e to the I k dot r, where r is the guiding center coordinate, okay, whose components do not commute with each other, right? So tau k, as an operator in the single particle basis, it has some matrix elements. So we define Cmn, we define the Fourier transform with this equation, where the Mn and N indices are replaced by matrix elements of this tau k operator, the magnetic translation operator. And then the coefficient of this Fourier transform is Ck, and we can check that the Ck satisfy usual fermion anti-commutation relations. And in particular, k is just an ordinary two-component vector defined. So the components of k commute with each other, blah, blah, blah. Right? Now, we can go to this momentum representation and we can Fourier transform the density operators, which are fermion bilinears, and check what algebra they satisfy. And indeed, the row left operators satisfy the GMP algebra that I mentioned before. And the row right operators satisfy the same kind of algebra, but with the opposite sign. And furthermore, row left and row right commute with each other. Now, the Hamiltonian is written entirely in terms of these row left operators, which satisfy the GMP algebra. But in representing this row left as a fermion bilinear in terms of these auxiliary fermion CK, we've introduced the redundancy. Namely, we've introduced these operators, row right, which satisfy this algebra and which commute with row left and hence with the Hamiltonian. And these operators must satisfy this constraint that row right acting on physical states is zero for all non-zero q. Okay? So I have a Hamiltonian written in terms of fermions. So each one of these is a these operators is a fermion bilinear. So I have a Hamiltonian written in terms of fermions and a constraint operator also written in terms of fermions, and the constraint commutes with the Hamiltonian. Right? So this is, in that sense, very similar to the familiar slave boson description of, say, correlated electron problems. In spirit, but in detail, it's of course more complex.
Quick question, so that you just clarification, I'd like to follow it.
Yeah.
Right, so you write algebra is basically like a gauge affair, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, and now you will turn to the gauging of the CU and how that all works. Is that correct? Because that looks to me very complicated.
This on the face of it, it looks complicated, but then it has nice properties that this is a, you know, it's a Lie algebra, it's an infinite dimensional Lie algebra, so is this guy. So there is a gauge group. And spiritually, we can do all the standard things we do in slave boson theory. In this formulation. It's just the gauge group is more complicated.
Yes, thanks.
Sure. So the first thing to do is to solve the model in Hartree-Fock. This is the analog of doing a slave boson mean field. So H is quartic in fermions. So we study it within Hartree-Fock. And a simple state that preserves all the global symmetries is to look for a state where there's an expectation value of C dagger K, C K prime, which has this form with some occupation number. And if we want translations to be preserved by the mean field, then it has to be proportional to delta of K minus K prime. So one can find such a solution. It turns out such a solution exists. And what it does is to give a quadratic fermion Hamiltonian where the fermions are acquired a dispersion and form a Fermi C with an area set by their density. So this is a mean field description of a composite Fermi liquid. Now, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to approximate this dispersion by a parabolic dispersion. It doesn't matter very much because we're only, in any case, interested in states near the Fermi surface. So the mean field action that comes from this approach is that it's a standard looking action. There's the familiar fermion time derivative, and then there's the fermion dispersion. An important question is, how are we going to go beyond mean field? So Reed went beyond mean field within a diagrammatic conserving approximation. But what we are looking for right now, you know, 22 years later, is not just to get the answers, but we want to derive an effective Lagrangian, which we can then use to do all kinds of things, which may be hard to do directly diagrammatically, right? And the key observation.
Sandhya, can I ask a question? What part of the process was it important that the filling factor, the bosonic filling factor was one? What if it is 0.98, what would change?
Yeah, so then you, in the formulation, you can't work with the CMN matrices which are square matrices. You have to work with rectangular matrices. And that introduces it introduces complications, which are physical complications having to do with sensibly defining a Fourier transform to go to the momentum basis. And it's not a bug, it's a feature of the physics.
I see. Thank you.
Sure. So the good news is that this mean field breaks this infinite gauge group generated by rho r down to just U1. And the only part of that group that's not broken is the generator at Q equals zero, okay? So this means that the goal of constructing an effective theory beyond the mean field is not simplifies dramatically. And we only need to include small Q gauge fluctuations on top of the mean field, okay? Now technically,
A clarification question.
Yeah.
Right, so in a normal slave boson or slave fermion business, right, the crucial thing is whether the bare CU is deep in the confining regime, and then you have to figure out some reason that it can become deconfining, and then the whole slave to give freedom against the life. I guess it's you're similar, and why is there no issue with confinement and deconfinement, blah, 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 although you have not quite the simplest, you know, global, what is it, non-compact?
No, no, so those issues are there just as they are in the usual theory. But the state, that the mean field state that we've formed, it has a, at the end of the day, you'll see that it has a forming surface coupled with U1 gauge field, and it enables, it admits a deconfined phase.
Yeah, no, I get you, but so there's some kind of interesting miracle going on when you take the mean field, that horrendously complicated gauge field you have reduces to a simple U1.
Hold your breath. You'll see that there's some subtlety in that statement, which is, in fact, one of the main points of the talk.
Okay.
Right. So in the next few slides, the exact structure will become completely clear, hopefully. Okay? So the difficulty in carrying this procedure through is that we've described the mean field simply in momentum space. After all, that's what you need to do. You have a Fermi surface. But the Rouhart transformations, it's easy to see that they mix states at different momenta, right? So including gauge fluctuations in k-space directly is hard. You know, it's always hard in any problem, and it's hard for the same reason, it's hard here as well. So you could try to circumvent that by going to the Landau orbital basis, the MNN basis, where the gauge transformations look simple. But then the mean field looks complicated, right? Because the mean field is only simple in k-space, okay? So that's the technical difficulty in dealing with fluctuations. And instead of following the usual route to deriving an effective field theory, and it turns out there's a very nice way to circumvent this technical difficulty, which is to take a somewhat abstract point of view, right? So we'll formulate the theory in non-commutative space and time, where space is non-commutative but time is not. So we'll define abstract fields as a function of the non-commutative guiding center coordinate by using the same operator, the magnetic translation operator, to go from these ordinary fermions to some weird object, C of R tau. So the components of the guiding center coordinates do not commute. So that's the famous story in a Landau level. So R, the guiding center coordinate, is an operator in the space of single particle states or the lowest Landau level, not in the Fock space, but in the space of single particle states. So therefore, this quantum field C of R tau is also an operator that defined in the single particle space of the Landau level. Okay? Now, the product of two such fields, C of R tau and D of R tau, since these are operators in this single particle space, they clearly do not commute. So if you take two such functions, F of R and G of R, you can ask about what their Fourier transform is. And the Fourier transform has some complicated expression which involves factors like this. So normally for two ordinary functions, this will be the Fourier transform, but without this factor, right? But here there's a new factor. Now there's a slightly different way to think about these non-commutative fields associated with any such operator value function, F of R. We can associate an ordinary field, F of X, defined in commutative space, X is a commutative space, to the standard Fourier transform. Right? We take Fk and make the standard Fourier transform. So then for given any F of R, there's a corresponding F of X. But then this, we can ask for the product F of R times G of R, which had that weird Fourier transform, how's that product, what is the ordinary function that's this ordinary field that corresponds to that product? And it turns out that ordinary field is not the ordinary product of F and G, but rather it's a more complicated product known as the star product that's defined through this equation. It involves not just F times G, but an infinite number of derivatives involving both F and G, okay? So the star product is well studied in the math literature. It's and so is non-commutative space. The star product is associative, but it's not commutative, okay? And you can define derivatives and integrals in this space and learn, you can do calculus in this space, and it's not quite hard to learn how to work with these non-commutative fields. So how does this help? Now, formulating the theory in terms of these non-commutative fields with products defined through start products means that there's a very simple action of transformation generated by row left and row R. Row left and row R act through left and right, star multiplication, where U left and U right are defined to be e to the I theta left or e to the I theta right. And the exponential itself is defined through a power series with all products being star products. Right? So you have a simple action of these transformations in real space, so long as we use the star product instead of the ordinary product. Now, the mean field action, formulated in terms of these non-commutative fields, also looks simple, once again, so long as we use star products for every product. So now we can go and do the more or less standard thing. We can require the action be invariant under long wavelength right gauge transformations of this kind. So we replace all derivatives by covariant derivatives.
Santa, can you say that, but the coordinates are not standard, they're all commutative.
They are commutative, that's right.
Yeah, the x is a normal now, okay.
That's right. So you could either work with these CRs when the R's do not commute, or you can equivalently work with these X's, but remember that the product is not the ordinary product.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so now we can carry through this procedure and replace derivatives by covariant derivatives. And the answer takes this following form, where the time derivative is replaced by a covariant derivative, and the spatial derivative is also by a covariant derivative. So the covariant derivatives are once again defined through a star product, the usual kind of thing. So literally mu is a dynamical non-commutative U1 gauge field that couples the right currents. And the capital A mu is a background non-commutative U1 gauge field that commutes the left currents. Okay? And the fermions are at finite density and they form a Fermi surface. And the gauge fields, we're only interested in gauge fields that vary slowly on the scale of the magnetic length. Of course, the fermions do not vary slowly on the scale of the magnetic length, because the Fermi momentum is of order 1 over the magnetic length. But the gauge fields vary slowly on the scale of the magnetic length. And this, by construction, has the required gauge invariance property under the infinitesimal version of the gauge transformations that I described earlier for the Cs and corresponding transformations for the gauge fields. Okay? So this theory has a Fermi surface coupled to a dynamical U1 gauge field without a Chern-Simons term, but it's formulated in non-commutative space-time, and that's an ingredient that is a crucial part of the story. And the Hartree-Fock theory gives an estimate for the bare effective mass in terms of the interaction strength. One can write a very explicit equation with actual numbers as p-factors that relate m star to the interaction strength. So how should we compare this with previous proposals for field theories of composite Fermi liquids, right? So all the previous proposed field theories are ordinary commutative field theories, right? But the theory I've obtained by starting with the Pasteur-Holliday and Greig description is a non-commutative field theory. However, non-commutativity occurs at the scale of the magnetic length, and what we can hope to do in order to compare with previous proposals is to approximate the long wavelength gauge fluctuations in terms of a coarse-grained commutative field theory, right? And then ask what structure that theory takes. So the key tool that enables us to do this was invented by Seiberg and Witten during the period in which non-commutative field theory was actively studied in high-energy physics. So this is a map that relates pure non-commutative gauge theory with gauge fields A mu to a commutative gauge theory with gauge fields A mu hat in a systematic expansion in powers of the non-commutativity parameter theta, which for us is just the magnetic length squared. So the expansion is local, and the coefficients only involve field derivatives with the same space-time point.
Does it correspond to any dimensionless small parameter that you expand with respect to?
Right, so, Good. So what this really means is that you're expanding in powers of Q times LB squared, where Q is the gauge field momentum. And in terms of the gauge flux being small on the scale of one magnetic unit of the magnetic length.
I see. Thank you.
So long wavelength, low amplitude gauge field fluctuations. Right. So anyway, so this mapping exists, and we'll need a small generalization that goes beyond pure gauge theory and includes the fermion fields. So this is done in perturbation theory in the original paper, powers of theta, but for pure beyond gauge theory, it turns out there's a non-perturbative version of the Seiberg-Witten map that exists, and condensed matter physicists might find very appealing a physical interpretation of this map in, that relates it to something that's well known in fluid dynamics, or the map between the Lagrangian and Boylerian descriptions. Okay, so to linear order in this theta parameter, we imagine expanding all the non-commutative objects in the theory to linear order in this non-commutativity parameter, and then demanding that the hatted fields satisfy the usual gauge length transformation of commutative field theory, while the unhatted fields satisfy the gauge transformations of non-commutative field theory. Okay? So it turns out that you can just work this out, and you can find this map explicitly in the for the theory that we are interested in. And then we can plug this in to get an effective commutative field theory. And when we do that, the answer turns out has the following form. So the first line are the leading terms that are leading order in theta. And remarkably, they take the same form as the standard HLR action for bosons at mu equals one. And the next term are the leading corrections to the HLR action in powers of theta. They involve higher gradients and so on. And the important thing that you obtain as part of the zeroth order answer is that the parameters of the theory, like the effective mass, are correctly given by the interaction strength rather than by the bare mass as in the original HLR theory, right? So what we've ended up with is that the commutative theory, yeah?
Is this equivalent to, let's say, if I take the star product, the exponential I partial, and I just expand on that exponential, do I get the same thing, or?
Yeah, but it is that expansion, but it's not totally trivial to do that expansion, because you also have to allow the gauge transformation parameter itself to depend on gauge field configurations.
I see.
Right, so that's the subtlety. But that subtlety was appreciated and worked out by Seiberg and Witten, so we didn't need to innovate very much.
I see.
Okay. So the commutative theory, the real theory that we get is the non-commutative theory. But if we want an approximate theory that's easier to work with, then we can work with the commutative theory. But the commutative theory has this Chern-Simons term exactly as expected in HLR. And this is traced to the non-trivial form factors in the density operator. I guess Chong was just asking about this. The non-commutative theory, which roughly corresponds to a non-trivial Berry phase. So the intuition that was present in this paper that Chong and I wrote a few years back is roughly correct. But in detail, the story turns out to be more complex than what we had envisaged. And one can use this commutative effective theory to study, we can now study Jane states near nu equals one, which are hard to do within the microscopic approach. And we do not find this fermionic vortex field theory that at least the few people who had thought about this issue before in previous years had assumed was the right description of the Pascal-Haldane-Reed microscopic story. We just obtained HLR, right? So in other words, we've derived HLR within a purely Lowe's land-level formalism for bosons at mu equals one. All right, so I should finish up, right?
I think you want to wrap up in the next, like, 5 minutes maybe.
All right, that's very good. I'll very briefly talk about part two of the talk, and then I'll do this very briefly and wind up. I also need to go and teach right after this, so I need to wind up. So. All right, so there's a lot more to be said and a lot more work to be done on the first part, but having shown progress on at least one question that's left over from the 90s or about lowest land level, now let me turn to part two, which is how to broaden the land level into a churn band to study the competition with the kinetic energy. Okay? All right. So there's a well-known way to broaden the land level into a churn band. It's probably known to Tholis in the 1980s, but many people have been using this trick. So suppose we take a land level and we turn on a periodic potential whose unit cell encloses exactly one flux quantum, right? You imagine there's a periodic potential in the lowest land level that encloses, well, the unit cell encloses exactly one flux quantum. You can take any lattice, but let's take a square lattice, that lattice constant L. Now, the advantage of having a single flux quantum through this unit cell is that discrete magnetic translations by one lattice spacing commute with each other, unlike generic magnetic translations. So then we can define crystal momentum inside a first Billow zone. And we can define a Billow zone associated with this periodic potential. So then we turn on this periodic potential, so it couples to the particle density in the usual way. There should be an integral over Q here that I forgot to write, where V of Q is just the Fourier transform of this periodic potential. Now, in the absence of interaction, the single particle Hamiltonian leads to a dispersion of the single particle states in moment, you know, the degeneracy of the land level, where all the crystal momentum states associated with this unit cell are degenerate if V is zero. But once we turn on V, the degeneracy is split. But since the crystal momentum is a good quantum number, there'll be an energy that the splitting of the degeneracy will be characterized by a dispersion as a function of K. So consequently, the lowest land level in the presence of this potential broadens into a churn band with non-zero bandwidth. Okay, so now we can write down a very simple model for this competition between topological bands, strong correlations, and kinetic energy. It's probably the simplest model, it's the simplest model that I can think of, which captures all three of these things. So let me walk you through the model. So it's really the lowest land level plus a periodic potential plus interactions. Okay? So the first thing to draw attention to is this: is that the model is written in terms of these density operators that satisfy this GMP algebra. So this encodes the fact that we are in a single land level and that the land level should be thought of as a topological band. So the second piece of the story is that I have the electron, the particle-particle interactions. So there are strong correlations, there are correlations in this band. And the third piece is that there's this periodic potential, which, as I just explained, gives you a bandwidth. Right? So all three of the ingredients that we're interested in are present. And if one can solve this problem, one will learn a great deal about this competition. So let me describe some of the limiting cases. If the potential is zero, then we're in this classic quantum Hall context, and all the familiar physics of quantum Hall we'll get, depending on the filling and the particle statistics. On the other hand, the interaction is zero, so we only have the periodic potential, then we have free particles in a dispersive band. So we'll, depending on the statistics, we'll either get a Bose condensate or a Fermi gas. And for small u, this Bose condensate will go into a superfluid, and the Fermi gas will go into a Fermi liquid, depending on the statistics. So as we change V over U, there'll be an evolution from whatever ground state we get in the quantum Hall regime to the standard conducting state, okay? So let me give you a few examples. So if we studied this model for electrons at mu equals 1/3, then we'll go from the Laughlin one-third state at V equals zero to at V being very large to a Landau Fermi liquid through some evolution, which this model will give us an answer for. For electrons at nu equals half, we'll go from the composite Fermi liquid in one limit to the Landau Fermi liquid. For bosons at nu equals one, we'll go from the Laughlin state, nu equals half bosonic Laughlin state to a bosonic superfluid, right? So these models are very good because they enable us in a concrete microscopic setting to talk about this competition. So I'll briefly mention the progress we've made in analyzing this evolution in the context of bosons at nu equals one, which I was just talking about in the earlier part, in the main part of the talk. So let's take this Pasquier-Haldane-Reed representation and then turn on a periodic potential. Now, this representation, because it works with the density operator directly, it's ideally suited to talking about incorporating the effects of the periodic potential, right? So we can do this within mean field, and the composite fermion dispersion, then they'll get a band gap at the Brillouin zone boundary, and the Fermi surface will then reconstruct into a particle-like sheet and a hole-like sheet of equal area, right? So just what I've shown here is an evolution of the band structure as V over U is tuned. Now, as we increase V, these particle and hole sheets will shrink and eventually disappear, and we'll get a band insulator of the composite fermions, right? Now, it turns out that you can, if you calculate the Chern number of these composite fermion bands, this occupied band has a Chern number of minus one, okay? So we're really going from a composite fermion metal to a composite fermion Chern insulator at the mean field level. Now, if we include fluctuations beyond mean field, in most of the talk, I talked about what happens in the zero V limit. And at weak V, it'll do the same thing. These composite fermions will couple to a dynamical U1 gauge field. And in the commutator approximation, we'll get a HLR-like theory. But in the large V limit, the composite fermions have filled the Chern band themselves. And we integrate them out, we'll get an effective action which has a quantum Hall-like Chern-Simons response for the gauge field seen by the composite fermions, which is A plus A hat plus capital A hat. In addition, there's the Chern-Simons term inherited from the HLR theory, and some simple algebra tells you that this is the same as this guy. And now we can do the integral over little a, and that sets capital A to zero, which means we get a superfluid, right? So this theory, this Pasquier-Haldane-Reed approach plus fluctuations, then gives us a way to describe the evolution from the usual composite Fermi liquid to the superfluid. At the mean field level, the description is a composite fermion metal to a composite fermion Chern insulator, and with fluctuations, we go from the usual composite Fermi liquid to the superfluid. So it all works out beautifully, and this one, in this class of problems, the class of models that I described a few slides back, there's one problem that we can actually solve with these methods. So we can do a number of other things with this Pasquier-Haldane-Reed method. So I'll just mention one generalization and then stop with some outlook. So a really interesting generalization that we are in the process of working out is to think about spinful electrons at total filling one. In the small V limit, we know that this goes into a quantum Hall ferromagnet. In the large V limit, it will go into a Fermi liquid. And what's the evolution as we increase V? So a composite boson theory, analogous to what I've talked about in the talk, can be formulated within the lowest Landau level to address this competition. And this evolution, it turns out, is something that's directly, you know, something that can be probed directly already in experiments in some of these Mourier graphene systems. So there's a direct experimental reason to understand how this evolution actually happens. All right. So there's lots of other things to do, both in standard quantum Hall theory. You want to know how to generalize this to other composite Fermi liquids, go to half filling. And in all cases, it's natural that the resulting field theory should be a non-commutative field theory whose form we still need to understand. And in the more general problem of correlated topological bands, the next step is to figure out how to deal with non-uniform Bay curvature and to deal with other kinds of band topology other than just churn bands. So let me stop here and thanks all for your attention.
Thank you. There's a question from Janandra. You can unmute yourself, Janandra.
Hi, Senthil. I may have missed, you may have answered this question already, but I had to go away for a couple of minutes. So you said you can derive the mass of the HLR theory microscopically. So can you say what it is? And there was this idea that this mass diverges actually in the infrared. So what does your theory have to say about that?
Good. So the mass is so because we are dealing with bosons with some short range interaction. Take as a concrete model bosons with the delta function interaction of strength U naught. Then the mass is inversely proportional to U naught. The mass is inversely proportional to U naught with a proportionality constant, which if I remember right is about 1.5. Okay, so there's a concrete number, but that's the answer to your first question. But let me answer your second question, which is what about the mass diverging, right? So this is the, if you wish, this is the mass that enters the field theory. The mass that I'm talking about is the mass that enters the effective action in the field theory. And then we have to deal with fluctuations. We have to solve this field theory to find the physical renormalized effective mass that will show up in an experiment, right? And that mass will be renormalized by gauge fluctuations in much the same way as people discussed a long time back, and that mass will diverge.
Okay, thank you.
I think there's a question from Dem Song, then Leo Lajovsky. So maybe Song can ask this question first.
Hi, Song.
Hi, Senthil. Is the non-commutative gauge theory that you describe an exact representation of the Lewis Landau level problem, or it is only a low energy approximation?
Yeah, okay, good. So it captures exactly the lowest Landau level constraint. Now, there are approximations that I've made in going from the microscopics to this theory. So what I've done is to, solve the interacting four fermion Hamiltonian that you get in the part one representation. I first solve it in Hartree-Fock, right? And then I've included, so that's the first approximation. And then the second approximation is that I've included the gauge fluctuations on top of that mean field, right? So those approximations have been made, but those approximations are faithful to the, so the most important thing is the constraint that imposes the lowest Landau level conditions. That constraint has been taken into account accurately.
Maybe the related question is that how sure are you on the form of the Lagrangian correction term in the Lagrangian? Is the coefficient supposed to be theta exactly? And are there other corrections that would appear in the same order of derivative expansion?
So we didn't find other. So within this derivative expansion, there's no further freedom in what this coefficient is, but it's dictated by the structure of the original non-commutative field theory, right? Mm-hmm. So there is no. You could ask a different question, which is if I start with this commutative field theory, and then let the theory run under some RG. Right. Will that renormalize this coefficient? That I do not know the answer to.
No, but my question is the mapping, approximation that you make, dictates the coefficient. If you are going beyond the approximation of the mean field, would this theta become some another coefficient?
No, not really. I don't see any scope for that because, you know, the answer could be wrong, not in some perturbative way, but in some non-perturbative way. Maybe non-perturbative is not the right word. For instance, one thing that we actually studied is that the competition at the mean field level with pairing, right? Now, if a paired state, and in fact, the paired state is, you know, it's the ground state for some interactions. Right? If that is the ground state, then we're starting with completely the wrong starting point to do fluctuations. Right? But so long as the mean field starting point is correct in the sense of it being a Fermi surface state, then the structure of the theory is rigidly dictated by the gauge. But the gauge structure determines the structure of the theory. And then this mapping seems to fix this coefficient to this order. That's exactly theta over 2.
Okay, so last question from Leo.
Yeah, Sandal. So I think I missed two key points, one key point that's, that your theory, relation your theory to HLR. So, you know, the two criticisms of HLR is, or shortcomings of HLR is, you know, the mass scale, let's say at least in mean field before you put in fluctuations, is not obviously all, you know, coming from interactions. And the second thing is, you know, this particle hole symmetry is not obvious. So what I'm confused about is you've mentioned this, but you haven't circled all the way around and connected to those two shortcomings. Does your
I said right at the outset that I only mentioned particle hole because it should be mentioned as one of the open issues from the 1990s.
It's the same shortcomings as the HLR in that regard.
No. So remember, the progress that I talked about is for the specific problem of bosons at nu equals 1. Mm-hmm. Where microscopically, there is no question of a particle hole symmetry.
I see.
The bosons do not have a particle hole symmetry, right?
Right.
So one of the things that we are working on is to eventually be able to, do this for fermions at nu equals 1/2, you know, repeat this kind of success at fermions at nu equals 1/2. And then if we work with a Hamiltonian that respected the particle hole symmetry, a microscopic Hamiltonian, the final answer should be, hope would naturally be this Dirac composite fermion theory.
I see.
But so that's not
okay. So this is just specifically for this nu equals 1 bosons.
That's right.
What was your comment to Jane about the, I missed the first part of it, about the, at, without fluctuations, what is the scale that M star given by?
It's the
parameter. Is that something?
Right. So the problem for which I know the answer at the top of my head is bosons with the delta function repulsion, U naught times delta of x, right, projected to the lowest Landau level. So then U naught is the only energy scale. U naught determines the energy scale in the problem, combination of U naught and LB. So the effective mass turns out to be, if I remember right, 1.54 over U naught in the mean field approximation.
I see.
Right. So that the point is not the precise number. Point is that the mean field spits out a number. Right? Dimensional analysis will give you the U-naught dependence, and the mean field gives you a concrete.
Okay. So it naturally comes out to be the interaction scale. That's my point.
Yeah, because we didn't, our starting Hamiltonian and nothing else.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, great. So we promised early on that these talks are not going to be more than 1.5 hours that we spend. About 1.5 hour, I think this is probably a good time to break. I'd like to thank Santil for a great talk. It was very interesting. I think we can always clap virtually, I guess.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. And we'll see you next week with Professor's talk on Monday, 12:30 p.m. EDT. So Thank you very much for coming, and see you next week.